The message was clear enough. They halted and turned around slowly. Delmar still had the sidearm in her hand, its red indication blinking. Very slowly she inched her aim back onto the robot, leveling the barrel in the direction of the blue eye. The white flash came again. It was a beam, lancing from the eye. It connected with the sidearm and exploded it instantly, leaving only the scorched stump of a handle and trigger grip. Delmar let out another yelp and flung aside the useless item.
"Worth a try,"
Dreyfus said, breathing hard. The robot had stopped, at least. It was a good meter taller than either of them, slender at the legs and broadening to a wide pair of double shoulders, the segmented arms nearly reaching the floor, each tipped with a three-fingered claw. The domed head was featureless save for that eye, which now locked onto them with a fierce, unblinking scrutiny.
"Who sent you?"
Delmar asked.
"I don't think it's here to answer questions,"
Dreyfus said when the robot gave no answer.
"How's your hand?"
"Scorched."
Slowly she raised her fist to her mouth and sucked at her thumb.
"I'll live."
"I'm going to draw a crumb of comfort here. It could have killed us easily by now. Do you need an anesthetic patch?"
"I'm all right."
There was a pause.
"But thanks for asking."
Dreyfus lowered himself onto his haunches, and then sat cross-legged on the hard marble floor, facing the robot, with his belly squeezing against his belt. Delmar looked at him.
"What are you doing?"
"Sitting down. I've a feeling we'll be here a little while."
He touched his collar.
"Dreyfus, is anyone reading me?"
There was a silence, a crackle, a silence.
"Let me try,"
Delmar said, lowering herself down next to him.
"Hestia, pick up someone. I need a suppression team. Escalation level amber. No, make that red."
She listened, frowned, repeated herself, not once but twice, and with steadily lessening confidence.
"Blocked,"
she confided.
"Either the dome, the house, or that robot."
"You have a head full of implants, Detective Marshall. Can't they get through to someone or find a way to tell that robot to stand down?"
"I've tried those things, and about a dozen more."
She sucked at her scorched hand again.
"I should have come in with some support. This will reflect very badly on me. Like it or not, you've been under my protection from the moment you arrived."
"We all make mistakes," Dreyfus said. "Comes with the job, I'd say."
He shifted his buttocks, the cold ground growing uncomfortable under him already. The robot seemed to take this as challenge, stepping forward by one menacing stride. Dreyfus raised a calming hand.
"Do you think Garlin sent it?"
"Thugs and hired muscle men are more his line. But you've poked your nose into this place before. Did you ever run into a robot?"
"No. Not like this."
After a short silence, she added,
"I studied your record, Prefect. I know you went up against the clockmaker. This isn't the clockmaker, is it?"
"No. You can rest easy on that score. If we were in the presence of the clockmaker, well, we'd know it, if only for the relatively limited amount of time it allowed us to remain alive."
Again she was silent. Once or twice, a new flurry of dust came down from the ceiling. The robot remained still, its arms dangling at its sides, but its eye swiveled occasionally, as if tracking some distant presence.
"I lost someone, too. Different circumstances to your own, but not without a certain ambiguity as well. You know of the 80, of course?"
Dreyfus found his interest piqued more than he cared for.
"Hard to avoid. We're still living in its shadow."
"I was 50 when Calvin began putting his first subjects through the destructive scanning apparatus. I was married then, in a triple valency. My husband and wife were Tyrone Lyle and Clemence Mersenne. Perhaps the names aren't unfamiliar to you. They were among the 80, among the earliest failures."
Dreyfus had reviewed the names often enough during his background investigations into Aurora, and he recognized the people of whom she had spoken. But there was a reason the name Hestia Delmar had not sparked off any sort of memory. She had not been one of the direct victims.
"Tell me what happened."
"Late in the day, I had second thoughts. It was a serious matter to back out. Money had been committed, reputations nailed to that particular mast, media attention around the clock. Calvin was very persuasive, confident of his theories, brushing aside our petty doubts. Most of us fell for it. But my qualms surfaced once the scans began. I liked life rather too much to chance everything on an unproven route to immortality. I backed out, about a month before we were due to be put through. Of course, there was a scandal, but within the Valency, we'd had an agreement. It was all or nothing. If one of us decided to withdraw, then so would the others. It was something we'd all agreed to, as serious as a marriage vow.
But they didn't, Dreyfus said softly, finally understanding, and at last realizing why Aurora had claimed something in common with Hestia Del Mar. They were both, in their different ways, victims of Calvin Sylvest.
Tyrone and Clements went through with it anyway. Calvin moved them up the list, and they were scanned within 2 days of my decision to withdraw. I wasn't even there when it happened. Calvin knew I'd have used every emotional appeal, every legal means, to stop it.
Dreyfus chose his words carefully. I'm sorry you were betrayed. But you've done more for Chasm City in one honest day's work than you'd ever have achieved as part of Calvin's botched experiment.
You barely know me, Dreyfus.
We're police. Different uniforms, different traditions, but not so far apart. The robot swiveled its eye again, tensing its body as if it meant to pounce. Dreyfus flinched in response. But he had heard something as well. It was a repetitive, dull tone, like someone striking a cracked bell over and over, and it was coming slowly nearer. Very gingerly he allowed himself to swivel around until he was facing the entrance to the lobby. Del Mar did likewise. The sound gained in volume, even while the interval between the tones remained unchanged. The robot's eye brightened, casting a confusion of shadows and highlights. Dreyfus tried to peer beyond the ruined entrance to the green swelter of the dome. A dark form loomed into view. It was a low, crouching figure, moving in a lopsided fashion across the terrace. Dreyfus stared, trying to fit this new apparition into his half-formed theories of Wildfire and the Voy family. The figure reached the doorway, a smudge of black against the green background of the dome. The figure tapped something long and hard against one of the sagging doors, then made a spider-like incursion through the irregular gap into the dust and debris of the lobby. Then it resumed its lopsided approach, ramming a walking stick against the marble, the tone shifting now that it was inside.
"Is this your robot?"
Del Mar called out.
"Answer me!" "You're in no position to be demanding answers from anyone," the figure called back, voice creaking with age.
Dreyfus continued staring. The man was hooded and gowned in black, no part of his face yet visible. He walked with a stoop, but there was also a boldness in the way he placed the stick, as if he had been using it for so long that it had become fully part of him. The robot tracked him with its blue eye, but clearly it had decided to tolerate the man's presence.
"I am Detective Marshal Del Mar of the Chamber for City Security. We are being detained here against our will. This is a serious crime."
"And your accomplice?"
Dreyfus answered for himself. "I'm an operative of Panoply. Here is a guest of Detective Marshal Del Mar. I'm investigating a series of deaths that have a link to this estate."
"Your authority begins and ends in orbits, Prefect. Here, you're nothing. You didn't even tell me your name."
"You didn't tell me yours." The figure worked its way around the debris piles, glancing up at the ceiling as if it might crash down at any moment. Dreyfus caught a glimpse of a sharp, pale face, with eyes like thumb holes.
"My name needn't concern you."
"I think it does," Dreyfus said. He made to push himself up from the ground, and the robot lurched forward threateningly. The man waved the stick at the machine.
"He may stand, Lurcher, as may the woman, but don't allow them to live."
"Who are you?" Dreyfus asked, feeling it couldn't hurt to ask again.
"I know who you are,"
Delmar said in a low, confiding tone.
The doctor. The family physician. It's you, isn't it? Dr. Something. Stralnikov? Stressov?
Stasov, the man answered. Dr. Balthazar Stasov. How well you remember me, Detective Marshall, for all my troubles. How well I lodged in your memory. You know this man? Dreyfus asked.
The former employee I mentioned? This is him. Dismissed from service due to some form of gross professional misconduct. After Alia died, he was interviewed as part of the routine investigation surrounding her death.
Tell the man I was innocent of any wrongdoing in that matter, Detective Marshall.
She sighed. He'd left the service before she died, so there was no suggestion he was involved in her murder. Naturally, he was interviewed in the aftermath of her death. The files say that he was tight-lipped, but otherwise cooperative, vouched for the family, gave credence to Marlon's account of the accident, said she'd often gone away on business, and was prone to cutting corners when she was in a hurry to get back home. The case was closed soon after.
But you reviewed it.
He came back to us, years later. Wanted to change his story. That's when he crossed my path. Why I looked into the older files. He wasn't credible, though. His new story didn't make any sense.
Don't feel you have to spare my feelings, Detective Marshall. Tell him what you really thought of me.
You were a broken man, Dr. Stasov. Ruined. Your reputation had been fragile to begin with. It was hardly a glittering career. The family took you on out of charity, hoping to give you a second chance. Then they had to dismiss you. You've been nursing your resentment ever since, desperate to get back at the Voice.
Is it true that you were dismissed? Dreyfus asked.
The hood slid from Dr. Stasov's head. He was bald, his skin wax-like, his eyes two dark, unblinking voids, his lips colourless, his mouth a black gash. His face contained a great many vertical wrinkles, his cheeks like drawn curtains.
I made an error, Dr. Stasov said. I attempted to learn the location of the Shell House.
You were in the service of the Voy family, Dreyfus said, confused. How could you not know where you were?
Things were never as they appeared, Prefect, Stasov answered. Not to begin with, and even less so as time went on.
Chapter 15. Spavo was called into the tactical room. He took his seat next to the one normally occupied by Talia, and swept his eyes around the assembled gathering, trying to judge the mood. The atmosphere was expectant, a nervous energy present, despite the obvious tiredness of the prefects and analysts. The seniors were leaning over to the analysts, whispering exchanges, tapping fingers at scrolling lists, mouthing agreement, or framing careful queries. Gaston Clearmountain and Jane O'Monier were studying the same compad, trading clipped observations. Lillian Beaudry was talking to someone via a microphone and earpiece, nodding in quiet, frowning concentration. Over in the room's left-hand corner, the solid orrery was in an unusually complex configuration, bristling with numerous enlarged habitats and dense thickets of annotation, the whole thing knotted in a mad tangle of orbits and trajectories. Mildred Dosso and Robert Tang were standing next to it with their backs to the table, engaged in a deft display of dual conjuring.
Ah, Bankal,
Omonier said, finally noticing his presence.
Someone close the doors, please. Has Garlin cracked?
Spavor asked, trying to uncover the reason for the heightened atmosphere.
No, not yet.
I'm putting him through a series of soft interviews, trying to root out inconsistencies. Claudette and Miles are with him at the moment. We'll go harder soon, but I want to know where his weak points are first.
Oh, this is yours, I think.
She reached down for something beneath the table, rolling his whiphound across to him.
You misplaced it, I gather?
Normally that would be a disciplinary matter, but... Omonier gave him the tiniest nod, the slightest forgiving smile.
You won't make a habit of it, will you?
Sparva took the whip-hound and clipped it to his belt.
I got it out of my system, ma'am.
Good. I believe you may have helped get it out of one or two other systems as well. Assuming this was an end to the matter, and the reason for his summoning, Sparva made to leave.
Wait,
Omanie said, raising her hand.
You're still needed. We're all still needed.
We have the opening we've been hoping for, Bancal. A breakthrough from the team at Elysium Heights. She glanced down, some urgent new report or analysis showing on the table.
Would you brief him, Ingvar?
Ingvar Tench cleared her throat.
Does Bancal know about the link to Julius Mazarin?
Julius who? Sparva asked.
An apparent alias of Julius Devengarlin Voy, when he was involved in the operation of the clinic. We have a video fragment, a sort of sales document. All the implications are that Garland was a senior figure in the clinic, more than likely the head of operations, if not the owner of the clinic itself. Of course he denies the connection.
Sparva frowned.
Wouldn't we know if he was running around operating a clinic? The recording could be 30 or more years old,
Tench answered. Garland wasn't a public figure then, and under the terms of provisions of the Common Articles, his movements aren't on record. Other than financing the clinic and monitoring its operation, his day-to-day involvement needn't have been close anyway.
Then why risk blowing his secrecy by appearing in a sales document?
Sparva asked. He was trading under the alias, and his clients wouldn't have had any a priori reason to suspect a link to the Voy family, Tench said. In any case, whoever mothballed the clinic must have thought they'd covered all their tracks pretty thoroughly, as they did, apart from this fragment and the patient list.
Which is corrupted to the point of uselessness,
Sparva said.
Was, Tench replied. It seems the technicals overlooked an intact record during their initial search. It came to light a little over an hour ago, giving us just enough time to begin adjusting our response strategy.
They overlooked something?
That's not like them.
Something about a search algorithm hitting some memory threshold, and then it cleared. Sparva nodded, accepting this at face value, even though it struck him as highly uncharacteristic of the heavy technical squad to have allowed such an oversight, no matter the technical reasons.
I have a question. How many names are there?
1,931. Tench said, but some have died by other means, and some have either left the system or vanished to the margins. That leaves 1,715 citizens who are still alive, still within the vicinity of the Yellowstone and the Glitter Band, still walking around. 85 are believed to be within Chasm City or one of the outlying settlements. That leaves 1,630 citizens on our immediate watch, sprinkled more or less randomly around the 10,000. Sparva understood the reason for the Solid Orrery's unusual configuration. It was undoubtedly showing the present locations of those citizens, and the habitats they were in. He thought of them going about their daily lives at this very moment, sleeping or awake, busy or idle, each utterly unaware that they had become the subject of Panoply's immediate and pressing interest.
"Can we get to them?"
he asked.
"That's what we're evaluating," Tench answered. "Supreme Prefect, you've seen the most recent coordination plans?"
"Yes, Ingvar,"
Omanie said, looking up from her readouts.
"Our aim is to secure each of those citizens as quickly as possible.
We're liaising with local constables as I speak. Where possible, they'll approach and isolate the citizens, without causing undue distress. Meanwhile, medical functionaries are being placed on immediate standing alert, and tasked into areas close to the citizens. Our threshold triggers will maintain their vigilance. The medicals will be ready to intervene if any of the citizens show signs of imminent wildfire." The lines around her mouth tightened.
"Of course, beyond cutting their heads off, there isn't a lot they can do."
"But we have other options," said Gaston Clearmountain. "Priority number one, after the citizens are located, will be to screen their implants for outside influence. Abstraction services will be reduced to emergency levels in the relevant habitats.
turned off completely in some instances, and that may help a little. But we can't rely on that as a solution.
Why not? Sparva asked. You saw it yourself, Bankal,
Omanier said. The lockdown failed in Fuchs in Nimburg. That means we can't depend on absolute control of abstraction or polling services. Even if we thought we had a block in place, a hidden signal might still be able to slip through. What's required is some sort of physical barrier.
Some of the habitats already have the means to establish isolation cages, Clear Mountain said. Where they are lacking, or can't be manufactured in a useful time, the citizens will be moved to other habitats or conveyed to our own facilities. Estimates suggest we can move to isolate around 600 to 700 citizens within the next 13 hours, with the rest following over another 26. That buys us a little time, maybe as much as we need. But it's only a temporary measure until we can get in and disable those implants. Again, medical functionaries are being tasked to lay the necessary groundwork. Our powers also allow us to requisition civilian surgical facilities and to delay any non-essential procedures while we clear the backlog.
And all of this without causing a panic? Sparva asked, raising a skeptical brow. It's all but unavoidable now, Omanier said. But I have one advantage I lacked before. Now I know the exact scope of our problem. If we act firmly and efficiently, we can declare the crisis contained and neutralized almost as soon as the panic breaks. The people will see it too. I have a duty to protect them from undue stress, but ultimately I believe in their reasonableness.
I do like an optimist, Sparva said. Talia had the sense he had been watching her for a while before she became fully aware of his presence. She waited for her eyes to find focus, and when that failed to happen, she made to touch her forehead, wondering why her skull felt as if it had swollen to the size of a balloon, monstrous and throbbing and huge, the rest of her no more than a limp, useless appendage.
Easy, Prefect Eng?
She made to speak, and nothing came out, except a senseless, guttural croak. Sparva's still blurred form reached out to a steely, skeletal thing that might possibly have been a trolley or bedside table, and then he was pressing a stiff, white surface to her lips, a gesture which struck her as both surreal and unwarranted, until she realized it was a cup, and she was expected to drink from it.
You can nod for the time being, Sparva said.
Demikov says he's spoken to you a couple of times, but you were groggy on both occasions, and he's not sure how much sunk in. She had to work hard to puzzle his words into a form she could understand. It was as if he spoke a twisty, difficult language that she had once studied and then allowed to grow rusty.
Just nod, Talia.
Sparva watched her reaction. You were as close to being dead as most of us get before the big day. But you got us Garlin. He came in with hardly a scratch on him. With a substantial effort of will, she placed these jumbled facts onto the murky, fog-shrouded terrain, which she knew to represent the larger picture. Garlin, the breakaway movement, the clinic, the polling cause. She remembered crowds and shouting. She remembered whiphounds and glass doors. She remembered walking around with someone's head in a box.
What?
She started again.
Garlin's here.
Omanier's putting the slow squeeze on him. He can't weasel out now, not after what happened in Fuchs in Nimburg. Not sure I'd have believed it myself, if I hadn't been there. But I saw that lockdown fail with my own eyes, and things like that just don't happen.
Sparva.
She forced his name out, a minor miracle, and took more of the water, cradling the cup with her own fingers.
I feel a mess.
Concussion. I think a skull fracture, too, but beyond that you got off lightly. I mean, not that I'd call those bruises
nothing, but... And you? I'm all right. Got knocked out, too, but only for a minute or two. I wanted to see you now because I'm going back out again. Didn't we both do enough? It's not as unjust as it sounds. I've had some rest, got one or two things off my chest, and now I'm ready to finish this off. Did Demikov mention the names? I don't even remember Demikov speaking to me.
We have the remaining wildfire cases. All the citizens who are ever going to pop. Now it's just a question of rounding them up and diffusing them. It's all hands on deck. They're giving me a cutter and a list of targets, and I expect it'll keep me busy for at least another 13 hours. I just wanted to drop by now, while they're turning the ship around.
Is it safe work?
Compared to our last couple of assignments? A walk in the park. The constables and medics are rushing around trying to pin down the citizens. All I need to do is ship them back here as quickly as I can.
I'd come with you, if I could.
You've earned an exemption on this one, Eng. Something floated out from the base of her memory.
Are you still? What I mean to say, are you working for me, or am I working for you? I got my rank reinstated. I'm glad. It should never have happened the way it did.
Well, don't cut yourself about it too much. A sudden reversal of roles, like that, it was bound to be difficult.
I meant your demotion.
That's what I mean should never have happened.
Of course.
Sparva shifted. I'm glad you're going to be all right. I don't have too many friends in this place. Need to take care of the ones I do have. She studied his face, lingering over the strangeness in it, but also the humanity, reminding herself of the times when he had shown her loyalty and support, even when he had borne some cost to that support. A true colleague, in other words, but more than that. A friend she had turned to more than once, and knew she would have cause to rely on in the future.
I feel the same way.
I'm glad. That would have been a hell of an awkward speech if it turned out you couldn't stand the sight of me. She managed a laugh.
Thank you for dropping by. You didn't have to, and I appreciate it. Have you heard from Dreyfus?
No. He's still down in Chasm City, trying to find some more dirt to shovel onto Garland's reputation. Not that we need it now. We've got the patient list, and we've got a younger Garland showing up under an alias in the clinic itself. Sparva tightened his belt, making a quick, patting inventory of his equipment. He'll crack sooner or later. Then it's just a question of making him stop the deaths.
Do you think he'll give in so easily?
He's got some fight in him still, but maybe not as much as he did before that mob trampled his smirking face into the dirt. Talia nodded, her thoughts still foggy, but something nagging at her with the odd and troubling insistence that often came with waking to a half-glimpsed connection, some clue or link furnished by her unconscious link.
Sparva, will you do me a favour?
Only if it's the sort that doesn't get me into trouble again. I don't think they'll let me have a compad in here. Not when I'm supposed to be resting, but I've still got pangolin clearance, and I want to see the files on the Terzet Frilla death again. It was open and shut, or as open and shut as any of the wildfire deaths, wasn't it? She gave him her best, pleading look. For the third or fourth time, Dreyfus attempted to get up from the cold marble floor, only to have the robot stomp towards him with sudden and menacing intent, flexing its arms and spreading wide its three clawed hands.
"Do you mean to kill us, Dr. Stasov?" he asked. "I only ask because you might want to get on with it. Both of us will soon be missed by our respective agencies. Enforcement squads will arrive. More than you or that robot are capable of resisting."
Dr. Stasov leaned in on his stick. Dreyfus and Delmar had turned to face the robot again, and now the doctor was to their left, carefully avoiding interposing himself between his prisoners and the machine.
"Are you trying to provoke me, Prefect?" he asked.
"He's just trying to get at your plans for us," Delmar said, giving Dreyfus a narrow, warning eye. "You had this robot waiting here to ambush someone. It took you a little while to arrive, though, so I suppose you were somewhere else, waiting for a signal. What did you hope to gain by capturing a police officer?"
"You were never the object of my interest, Detective Marshall.
The truth is I'm disappointed to find you here instead of one of them."
"Them?" Dreyfus asked. "The boys.
I hoped one of them would come back eventually, if only to burn this old place down, erasing the last trace of the old falsehood. The robot was theirs, did you know? Lurcher, the family retainer, guardian and groundskeeper. When it was no longer of use, they sold it to a third party. Better that they should have destroyed it, or left it to rust. But no boy has ever turned down the chance to make a small profit, even at their own eventual cost. Delmar asked, "Were you that third party?" "No. That would have roused immediate suspicion. The robot passed from hand to hand over a period of years, until I had the means to acquire it. I badly wanted access to Lurch's security settings. I was hoping there might be a clue in them, some vital data fragments which hadn't been properly erased or reset." Dreyfus looked into the doctor's lavishly wrinkled and ancient face, trying to read the sunken, void-like eyes. "And was there?" "No. They'd been more thorough than I hoped. But the robot retained some basic knowledge of the estate's layout, and that at least allowed it to serve as my watchdog. I set it here to wait and report. Trespassers came and went, the occasional city official. But it was them I wanted to find." Spittle ejected from the bloodless gash of his lips. "I confess that lately I placed the robot on a higher degree of alertness, thinking a visit all the more likely. Otherwise it would have concealed itself more effectively, and allowed you to complete your pointless investigation in peace. Julius Devon Garlin Voy still has the deeds to this place," Dreyfus said. "It's still his, in a legal sense, even if he downplays the family connection. Why would he allow you to come and go?" "The place is of no concern to them. They've left it to fester, an informational dead zone. The abstraction doesn't penetrate here by design. The dome rebuffs it. The family craved their privacy, their insularity. My alert was a simple radio frequency trigger with just enough power to reach beyond the estate. A risk even in that, but one worth taking." "You keep saying them," Dreyfus said. "For a reason," Stasov answered. "There's only one living heir. Alia died, then Marlon. Now there's just Julius, calling himself Devon Garlin. There were always two sons," Stasov said. "I have every reason to think they are both still alive." "No," Dreyfus said, shaking his head. "If anyone knows that family inside out, it's me. Julius was an only child. He grew up here with his mother and father, and when Alia died, he set out on his own. There was never a sibling." "You're wrong on two counts," Stasov told him. "There was a brother. His name was Caleb. They were non-identical twins. I know, because I was often called to the household to monitor their progress. The boys were being groomed, shaped for greatness, and they didn't grow up here." "Julius certainly did," Dreyfus said. "I assure you, he didn't," Stasov said. "There's another one, you see. Another shell house." "I told you he had a story," Delmar whispered. Stasov leaned in, as if he had only just caught her words. "Yes. And I came to you with it often enough, didn't I? I asked only to be given the benefit of the doubt. But even that was too much. You weren't the most credible witness. And perhaps there was just too much at stake to risk challenging the reputation of a powerful man of the people, such as Devon Garlin. Perhaps the sacred name of the Voys couldn't be allowed to be tarnished, even when a terrible crime had been committed." "You mean Alia's death?" Dreyfus asked. "Before that." He jabbed the stick against the floor, for emphasis. "I don't mean to belittle her death. For all I know, maybe it was an accident, after all. Between her and Marlin, she was at least the more cautious one. Maybe the only one with a shred of human decency left in her soul.
although they were both implicated in... We looked into his claims, Dalmar said, allowing her voice to rise defensively. We're not so blinkered that we'd dismiss someone with a story about Devon Garlin, even when they had every reason to loathe that family. But the doctor's accusations couldn't be verified.
Were they disproven? Dreyfus probed.
No, but they couldn't be verified.
She glanced away, almost as if she didn't wish him to see the guilty look on her face.
We observed due diligence. Would Panoply have acted any differently if you had 100 other problems demanding your attention?
Dreyfus fixed his gaze on Stasov, forcing himself not to blink or flinch from those dead black eyes.
Are you a man of conscience, Doctor?
Why do you ask?
Because I want to trust you.
Dr. Stasov regarded him for several long seconds, judgment and calculation flitting across his ancient and cavernous face like cloud shadows on rock.
I am not a good man,
he said slowly, a strain opening in his voice.
I would never pretend to that.
But I always tried to do right by those boys. I thought, for a while, that they had it in them to rise above the circumstances of their origin. I thought they could become better men. Good custodians.
A dark tongue licked the pale margin of his mouth.
I was wrong.
Then he turned his eyes to the robot. Let them stand, Lurcher. They're not the ones we were waiting for. Dr. Stasov reached out a hand to Dreyfus. His fingers were extraordinarily long and thin, and they seemed to have too many knuckles and joints about them. Dreyfus took the hand warily, as if it might break into brittle, twig-like shards at the first touch. He was mistaken. It was stronger than it looked.
"Who is with him now?"
Aumonier asked, while she was being inspected, at her own insistence, for concealed devices.
"Sanquois and Jaffna?"
"No, ma'am,"
answered the fresh-faced duty prefect, newly promoted from Field 3, and visibly nervous at having to perform a sweep and pat-down of the Supreme Prefect.
"I understand they didn't get very far. Senior Prefect Beaudry's in there now. Would you like me to tell her you're ready to take over?"
"That won't be necessary, Chin."
"Am I clear?"
The flustered, sweating Chin stepped back from the inspection.
"You're clear, ma'am."
"That's a relief to us both.
Extend the bridge and then pull it back when I'm inside.
I'll need about 30 minutes.
Chin operated the controls that pushed out the pressurized bridge, connecting to a door in the side of the cube.
"You'll be out of contact once the bridge withdraws. Any emergencies, you can always hammer on something. The braces will pick up the acoustic signal."
"Thank you, Chin. You'll be astonished to hear that I've done this once or twice before."
The bridge completed its extension. Aumonier walked across, mentally preparing herself, running through the things she was prepared to discuss and the things she had decided to withhold, until, if, they proceeded to trawl. She closed the airtight door behind her, then went through the latticework of secondary doors that led through to the interviewing suite. It was a simple affair, after all the external technicalities. A windowed partition divided the space into two rooms. The partition was fitted with one-way glass, composed of inert material rather than quick matter. One room was an observation area, so that one or more prefects or citizen observers might witness an interview in progress. On the other side of the glass was a bare room containing a table and three sturdy grey chairs. Power, illumination and life support was provided by rugged, self-contained systems entirely independent of the rest of Panoply. Garlin was on one side of the table, Beaudry on the other. Aumonier rapped her knuckles on the partition's connecting door and admitted herself into the interviewing cell.
"Where is my citizen quorum?"
demanded Garlin sharply, breaking off from whatever he had been saying.
"I have my rights. You can deny me access to my legal representatives, but you can't deny me my citizen quorum."
Aumonier eased herself into the vacant seat next to Lillian Beaudry.
"Under Executive Clause 6/1, subparagraph 5 of the Common Articles," she explained in a pleasant, obliging tone, "that's exactly what I can do
We are under emergency conditions, and as such it wasn't feasible to locate and deputize a standing quorum, each of whom lacked any sort of neural implant. That's a twisting of the laws to suit your own ends, Garland said. It isn't, Omanier clarified, still in the same friendly spirit. The onus is on me to ensure the safety of that citizen quorum, and I couldn't in all conscience guarantee I'd be able to protect them. Protect them from who? Omanier blinked, feigning surprise. From you, Mr. Garland. Who else did you think I had in mind? Don't be absurd. What are you expecting me to do? Reach through that glass? Wait. Wait! He shifted his gaze onto Beaudry now, something tightening in his brow. What she was asking me about those citizen deaths. The wildfire rumours. That clinic you kept going on about. Are you seriously suggesting I had something to do with all that? Then you admit to your knowledge of wildfire, Beaudry said in a smooth, judicial tone. She mentioned it, he said, eyes widening as he looked back at Omanier. When she dragged me in, Omanier was the one who mentioned wildfire. I'd never heard of it until that moment. You can't blame me for knowing you had a problem. The rumours have been flying around for months. But that doesn't mean I knew what it was. The trouble is, Omanier said, you seemed to know rather too much for a man who just happened to have his ear to the ground. Not only about wildfire, but other things. You seemed to have an almost preternatural ability to anticipate the movements of my operatives. When a man has a vendetta against you, you get pretty good at guessing his moves, Garland said. How do you explain the failure of the local lockdown in Fuchs in Nimberg? Omanier said, still keeping her manner ruthlessly civil. Your gathering couldn't have broken through into the polling corps by force alone. Yet you seemed content to bide your time, knowing that the doors would open. Don't blame me for your mistakes. It wasn't a mistake, Omanier answered. It was the unprecedented breakdown of a system that shouldn't ever go wrong. Unlikely as it seems, I'm forced to one conclusion. Someone was able to reach in and disable the lockdown using channels reserved for high-level security operatives only, yet at the same time, leave no trace of their intervention. He folded his arms, lifting his chin to her. It was finely stubbled, making him look a little older than his usual public guise. And have you found this mythical individual? I think I'm looking at him, Omanier said. To his partial credit, he did a good job of looking astonished, flustered and utterly enraged, all in the same quick blizzard of reactions. What? What? Are you out of your mind? You're a voy, Omanier said. I've never made any secret of it. No, Beaudry chipped in, but you've never advertised it either. It doesn't fit very well with your image as the strong man of the people, does it? Being born into one of the oldest, wealthiest families in the entire system? You couldn't be more part of the establishment if you tried. You've had every advantage in life, including access to the deepest secrets of the Voy clan. Your ancestor laid the template for our entire society, Omanier said, drew up the blueprints for everything we hold dear. Abstraction, polling, transparency, freedom of access to information. The doors of perception flung gloriously wide, but all of it built around the Voy kernel. It's uncrackable, sacrosanct. But if there was a flaw in the Voy kernel, maybe a deliberate one, who'd be in a better place to know about it than a Voy? I didn't have much faith in Panoply to begin with. Now I think you're unhinged. I'd hardly credit it myself, Omanier replied, but we have a proven link between the wildfire victims and your family. We think it happened under the auspices of a clinic called Elysium Heights, which was run by you under the alias of Dr. Julius Mazarin. Nearly 70 people are now known to be victims of that deliberate action. But there are many more who were programmed to die in the weeks and months ahead.
Garlin's face had hardened into a fixed mask of staring dismay.
"How much more absurd do you want to get a money, eh? You can blame me for the economy, if you like, as well. Or the fact that Black's in this year."
Baudry bent down to retrieve something between her knees.
"I brought images,"
she said, laying a cardboard dossier onto the table.
"Some of the early dead. Should I show them to him?"
"A few," Omanier said, "but we'll hold back the rest for the trawl." Baudry opened the dossier and extracted three shiny images. Rather than display them on a compad, she had taken the precaution of having them embossed directly onto paper by some ingenious chemical means. Each picture showed the face of one of the dead. The first was Cassandra Leng, the earliest victim known to Panoply. Baudry slid the pictures across to Garlin. He kept his eyes level, refusing to glance down.
"Look at it,"
Omanier said.
"Don't be ridiculous. You can't force me to look at anything."
"Ah, but I can. It's fully within the permitted scope of my interrogation methods. It's not an especially pleasant procedure, though, so I suggest you spare yourself the trouble." He kept his eyes fixed on her for several seconds, strain showing in his neck muscles, but some unconscious reflex, or twitch, soon broke the spell. It was a momentary glance, but perfectly sufficient for her purposes. She watched him carefully, comparing his expression before and after that glance, vigilant for the tiniest betrayal of recognition. She had to hand it to him. Devon Garlin did a good job of seeming not to know Cassandra Leng.
"One or two more,"
Omanier said.
"Before I accompany you,"
Dr. Stasov said, his stick clacking on the hard ground beneath the weeds, "perhaps you'd clarify the terms of our association."
"What do you think needs clarifying?" Dreyfus asked.
"Is this an arrest?"
Stasov asked. "You have the authority, I suppose, and despite appearances, Lurcher would not use violent means to prevent my detention."
"You've already interfered in the course of an investigation," Delmar said, raising a hand to her voluntor, signalling it to begin preparing for departure. "Forcefully, too. That's grounds enough for me to bring you in, before we start with trespassing."
"If you can be of service to us," Dreyfus said,
"then I'm minded to set aside any earlier misunderstandings. But you're going to have to work hard to convince me that we're not in the Shell House."
"Of course this is the Shell House," Stasov said. "Just not the only one. The Voys' wealth and influence brought great freedoms. They could come and go as they pleased, flying in and out of Yellowstone with nothing but the most cursory of checks. On the rare occasions in later life when they needed to entertain, this is where it happened. This is also where Marlon returned with Julius after Alia's death, and where he saw out his grief, playing the role expertly."
"And the other place?" Dreyfus asked.
"In space, located in another piece of Voy real estate, spun up to simulate Yellowstone gravity, and rendered exactly down to the last crack, the last grain of dirt, so that you couldn't tell one from the other. To begin with, when I first started visiting the boys, I came here. By then Julius and Caleb were 8 years old, or so I was informed. They had kept them out of the way until then, but I think Marlon and Alia were growing nervous. The estate was private enough, but still much too close to Chasm City for their liking. They were worried that something beyond their control might result in the boys being discovered."
"Why?" Dreyfus started.
Delmar touched a hand to his shoulder as she set foot on the volunteer's boarding steps.
"Let him continue."
"Marlon and Alia decided to continue with the boys' development in space, where their privacy could be more easily controlled. But they didn't want it to be any sort of upheaval. So they created a second Shell House and grounds, and the boys were drugged and shipped there without anyone being the wiser. They went to sleep in one bedroom and woke up in another, and even the boys couldn't tell the difference. It was the perfect solution. There was just one irritant."
"You?"
Dreyfus said. They had grown dependent on my services, as I had grown to need their flow of funds, small as it was. They knew some of my secrets, and I knew some of theirs. A mutually beneficial symbiosis. So they elected to continue hiring me. Once every few months I was obliged to visit the boys. But I was not permitted to know the whereabouts of this second shell house. In fact, no mention was ever made that there had been a change. I was to go along with the charade, never questioning it. The only complication was that I, too, was required to be drugged and put to sleep. So I went along with it, across numerous visits. I would come here and awake there. I guessed soon enough that it had to be in space. There were too many missing hours from my life for it to be anywhere else. But I wasn't permitted to know the whereabouts. Dreyfus climbed in after Delmar, then extended a hand to help Dr. Stasov. I'm guessing you tried to find out.
Yes. My ultimate undoing. I concealed a small inertial tracking device about my person, disguised as one of my ordinary medical instruments.
They were all aboard. Delmar closed the door and took the Volantor into the air, aiming it for the gap in the dome by which they had entered.
And did it tell you where you'd been taken?
Dreyfus asked.
It provided a set of orbital coordinates, with a margin of error. I would have needed to make several trips to obtain a definite fix. What I had, though, was convincing enough for my purposes. Tell him, Detective Marshall. I think it would be far better coming from your lips.
Lethe,
she answered, not without a moment's reticence. The last significant piece of orbital real estate still tied to the Voy family. Dreyfus stared at the doctor, astonished at what he was hearing.
You checked his story, didn't you? He gave you a place, a name.
Not our jurisdiction, Delmar said, turning around sharply in her seat now that the Volantor was in open air.
So you asked. You went through the usual channels. Tell me you did that much.
We felt that discretion ought to be exercised. Our request was framed as part of a larger investigation into minor tax irregularities concerning a number of orbital holdings.
And I can bet that was top of Jane O'Money's list of priorities, Dreyfus said.
Even if Stasov's story is true, what they did is weird, not illegal.
There's no law that says you have to tell the truth to children.
She's never really believed me, Stasov said.
It would have helped if you'd been able to show me some physical evidence to back up your account. But you couldn't even produce the tracking device.
They confiscated it as soon as it was discovered. I was dismissed shortly afterwards.
You're lucky they stopped at dismissal, Dreyfus said. Those big families can be ruthless.
Better to keep me on a long leash with blackmail and threats. For all they knew, they might have had some need of my services again.
Did they? Dreyfus asked.
No. There were tensions growing. Alia felt that the boys were being given too much power too soon. She didn't trust them with it, and as time passed, her doubts grew and grew. I was party to some of the disagreements between her and Marlon.
Dreyfus wanted to ask about the powers granted to the boys, willing for the moment to indulge Dr. Stasov's conviction that there was another son besides Julius. But he had a more pressing question.
Then Marlon might have had a motive to murder Alia, if the two of them were arguing over the boys.
I have no love for either Marlon or Alia, Dr. Stasov answered. What they did was indefensible, but neither was capable of killing the other. If suspicion should fall on anyone, it would be one of the boys. I studied them carefully before my dismissal. Both showed rapid development, a keen ability to wield their new gifts. But Caleb was generally the quicker, stronger one. There was a meanness in him as well. Perhaps it would have flowered in Julius, given time. But Caleb was the one who most concerned me.
and the one about whom Alia had the most doubts as well. Could Caleb have done it?
Dalmar asked, addressing Dr. Stasov.
Most certainly, he said, especially if she tried to take away his toys. He wouldn't have cared for that at all.
Sparva docked the cutter at the first of his pickup points. He had come in fast, ramming the habitat so hard that they must have felt the bump all the way to the far end cap. A little rude, a little discourteous, but he had dispensation, and the local constables were expecting him to exercise all haste. He just hoped they were playing their own parts with the same sense of urgency. He need not have worried. They were waiting on the other side of the airlock. Constables and medical functionaries, his jolting arrival not only forgiven, but entirely excused, given the nature of the emergency. They barely seemed to notice that he was a pig, so novel was the situation. The constables and functionaries seemed glad to have finally been let in on the secret, even if it was only in the bare details. They had their citizen with them, the one Sparva had been sent to collect, a worried-looking man of apparent middle age, with a tall, flat-topped bristle of grey hair rising back from a high, agitated brow.
The Supreme Prefect's still determined to avoid unnecessary citizen distress, Sparva said, as he checked off the pickup details on his compad. So you'll understand that the details of the emergency must be disclosed on a need-to-know basis only. That said, I'm authorized to inform you that we have a clear idea of the total number of citizens who need protecting, and it's well within our combined response capability. One or two more fatalities are probably unavoidable over the next couple of days, but the risk to any individual citizen on our target list is much less than 1%. He nodded at the man they had brought to the dock, hoping to strike a note of professional reassurance. You're one of the fortunate ones, citizen. We'll have you back at Panoply very shortly, and there's no safer place for you in the whole Glitterband. You'll be looked after, and when the emergency has passed, which should only be a few days, you'll be returned home.
I don't know why I've been brought here, the man said, looking around with widening eyes. No one's telling me anything.
Citizen.
Sparva glanced down at the name, the first of the 10 individuals he was required to ferry around.
Mr. Devereux, this is upsetting for you, I appreciate, but it's all for your own good. The Supreme Prefect has determined that you may be at risk of a sudden and serious illness. Luckily, the cause of this illness is understood, and we have the means to both protect you and remove any possibility of danger in the future. But to do so, we have to act quickly and efficiently, and that means you need to come with me.
Have I done something wrong?
No, you've done nothing wrong, but we have a duty to protect you, whether you wish it or not. Come with me, Mr. Devereux. I've a busy day ahead of me, and you're just my first pickup.
The handover was completed. Sparva thanked the constables and medical functionaries for their assistance, promising them that they had the gratitude of Panoply and the Supreme Prefect in particular, and that they would be kept fully informed of ongoing developments. He could feel their excitement starting to sag by the second, as they realized their moment of intense usefulness was already drawing to a close. He felt for them, too. This was one of the many thousands of decent, unexceptional habitats that just got on with being a part of the Glitterband, abiding by the common articles, seldom making the news and almost never testing the patience of Panoply. Its citizens lived contented, if uneventful, lives, generally happy with their lot. Being a constable in such a place was not exactly the most demanding of callings. He imagined the conversations that might go on later, as the constables and functionaries relayed developments to spouses and loved ones.
Today we had to collect a man and take him to the dock. A prefect came all the way from Panoply for him. Can you imagine? A prefect! And a pig, as well!
Sparva made sure his charge was buckled in, then undocked with the same haste that he had come in.
Bancal, inbound to Panoply, he said, calling ahead. One down.
Chapter 16 Caleb was the first to notice the change. The boys were out in the grounds,
entertaining themselves with contests of quick matter shaping and manipulation of the consensual visual field. Julius lacked his brother's competitive streak, but he was happy to go along with any sort of game that did not involve hunting and death, no matter how illusory the sport. They were standing close to each other in an area of cleared ground, struggling to assert their individual will.